not knowing what to talk about again. Somebody asked me just before I came in here, why is it, according to the Buddhist idea of, you know, rebirth or reincarnation, that sometimes a person works so hard in their life and they do so much effort, but what carries on into their future life, and what you can see in a baby, is not much left from their previous existence, where you have to walk again, you have to learn all these things again, you have to do it all over again. And why is not more kept, or what actually is kept from life to life? And I thought I'd use this question as an opportunity to just to explain just the process of the mind, just how this mind works and how it propels us into a future life, and exactly what's going on here, because that will give us some indication of, you know, how to invest for our future. Not only that, but just it shows us how we should be investing for our present moment as well. Because the same spiritual qualities which will drive you forward into a beautiful new existence are the same spiritual qualities which give you happiness and peace and a sense of meaning right now. But when people ask, you know, not if there is reincarnation or not, that's a question which some of you might know, but others of you will have to wait for a while before you find that question out. And of course you'll find the answer out after you die. That's why the old joke goes, if you don't believe in reincarnation in this life, don't worry, because you certainly will in your next life. But today I'm going to be talking about like the process of rebirth. And the best simile which I have managed to concoct is the simile of the two mangoes. So imagine a mango, and you eat it today. I don't know about you, but I like mangoes. We use many mangoes in similes in Buddhism, I don't know why. Maybe it says something about my cravings and desires, but nevertheless. Imagine a mango, and you eat it and enjoy it, and you take the seed and you put it in your garden. And you water that mango, and after a while the mango germinates and a shoot comes out, and you look after that little sapling and it grows into a nice tree, and eventually the tree flowers and you have another mango. Now we know that those two mangoes, the one you ate years ago and its descendant on the tree from which it grew, they are connected there. They're connected, but it's also totally different from the first mango to the second mango. If you compare those two mangoes, the one you ate and the new one from the seed, there's probably not even the same DNA in there. There's always mutations, you know, from time to time. Certainly there's no sort of even molecules which are in the new mango that were there in the old mango. So it's a totally different mango. But nevertheless, you can see a connection. A cause and effect process. So in other words, at any moment in time, you can find the link between where, say, that sapling came from, and you know where that sapling is going to. And you have this whole chain, this connected chain of links from the first mango and the seed inside of it to the new mango and the new tree. And this actually, this chain of events, this cause and effect process, is how even the Buddha described this life and also that incredible time where we go over the horizon from this life into what's beyond, into a new life. But first of all, just working on that simile of the mango, you can see if the mango which you ate before was very sweet and juicy, it's very likely the new mango will be juicy. If the mango you ate was sour, it's very likely the new mango will be sour. There has been some tendencies which have gone across from one mango to its descendants. And it's that tendency, what we call the inclinations. This is actually what we always say goes across from life to life. The thing in itself, there's no connection, there's no sameness there, but there is this connection, this cause and effect process, which carries with it, you know, the tendencies, the character traits, our inclinations, which we build up in this life. Now, of course, to see ordinary things which are easy to do, which are easy to make, those things don't get carried over. Anything which is going to last, which is deeply embedded in a human being, are things which have been built up for a long time with a lot of effort. That's why I call them the inclinations and the tendencies and the character. I know that sometimes people, they look at themselves and they think, well, I'm getting too angry, I shouldn't get angry. How hard is it to change your character? You can't just decide, oh, I'm never going to get angry again. Oh, I'm always going to be kind. I'm always going to be more friendly. These are character traits which take a long time to develop and also a long time to change. The deeper they are, the longer it takes to change. Which is why sometimes it takes a whole lifetime to create these characters, these positive parts of ourselves. Which is why we have a spiritual life. And if you think about it, a spiritual life of doing good things and being kind and being generous and being peaceful, being wise, which is why many of you are here, because you know, something which we think is just really important in whatever's taught here. We can actually feel it when we meditate, and sometimes we can hear a few words from one of the teachers who speaks here, and it inspires us. And it gives us more clarity and direction in our life. There is something really important here. And you can see that what that's pointing to is some of these deeper truths, you know, which we call, you know, the spiritual truths, which not only give meaning now, but these are the things which are carried on into a future existence. I'm not sure that sometimes I hesitate to tell stories from my book, Open the Door of Your Heart. But whenever I tell these stories, it's amazing just how many people either haven't read that book, or if they have read that book, maybe it's because they're getting old and getting Alzheimer's, they can't remember those stories. So, you know, I usually get, you know, an elderly group of people coming to this centre. So I'm telling a story about the man with the four wives. It's a classic story which indicates, you know, how rebirth happens. So once upon a time, there was a man with four wives. That's a crazy guy. I haven't got one wife, I'm much happier. But he had four of them. So this poor guy had four wives. And he was getting towards the end of his life. And he was actually on his deathbed. He thought he was going to die. And he starts to get worried about what happens after you die. And so he called his fourth wife, the wife he married later on in life. And she was very, very attractive. In fact, she was so beautiful. She made many, many things possible for him, especially invitations to high society. She was his passport into the A-list of parties and receptions and concerts in the city in which he lived. And so he brought her to his bedside and said, "Darling, I love you very much. You've been so good to me." She said, "Yes, I love you, darling, too." And he said, "I'm about to die." "Well, that's so sad," said his fourth wife. "And I'll be lonely without you. Will you come with me into death?" "What? No way! I'm not going to die with you. What do you think?" He said, "But what I will promise you, I will go to your funeral, I promise you that. And I will speak a wonderful eulogy about you. I'll praise you to everybody." "Is that all?" said the man. "That's all I can do and all I will do." "I thought you said you loved me." "Get out of here!" And he chased his fourth wife out. And he brought his third wife in. He'd married her before the fourth wife. And the third wife, now wasn't, you know, it's a bit older. But still, she was very attractive. And in fact, you know, some of these older women are very, very attractive, you know, to many men. So it gives you hope, doesn't it? And the third wife had been really, really helpful for him. And she'd made probably even more things possible. She made him get a comfortable house and a comfortable living, all because of, you know, the third wife and what she was. And so he brought his third wife in and said, "Darling, I love you very much too. I'm very attached to you." And she said, "I love you too, darling." And he said, "I'm about to die. And I'm afraid. Will you come with me into death?" "No! It's never been done and I can't do that. I won't do that. But one thing I can promise you, I won't just go to your funeral, I'll pay for it. And I'll make sure you get a wonderful funeral." And he said, "But then what would you do?" He said, "Well, after you're dead, I'll probably go with your eldest son." "What? As adultery, and I haven't even died yet. Get out of here, you shameless scallywag hussy." And he sent his third wife out. He still had two to go. So he brought his second wife. He'd married his second wife a long, long time ago. And she wasn't pretty at all. But she was one of those women who was really wise and helpful. She was always there for him, especially in times of trouble. And she looked at his second wife and said, "Well, I've known you for such a long time. I'm about to die. I'm really afraid of dying and being alone. Will you? I know these other two said no, but will you please come with me into death?" And the second wife looked at him and started crying. She said, "Darling, I'd really love to. If I could, I would. But all I can do is come to your graveside. That's as far as I can come. I'm sorry." "Get out," he said. And he still had one wife left. And this wife, he'd known her for so long, he couldn't remember the time before he met her. And she was very neglected. The two later wives got all of the jewelry and the fine clothes. And so the first wife, she was very poorly dressed, bad hair, but behind the scenes, she was working so hard for him. He never really appreciated her or really supported or helped her at all. And he looked at her and said, "You're my last chance. I've known you for so long and I'm so connected to you." And she said, "Yeah, we've got this very deep connection together." And he asked the question, "I'm about to die. Will you come with me into death?" And she smiled and said, "Sure, I will. I go with you everywhere. That's why my name is Mrs. Karma. I go with you from life to life. And your second wife, Mrs. Family, your family love you. And they will always support you and be there with you. And they can go as far as your graveside, but no more. You can't take them with you. And as for the third wife, that was called Mrs. Money. You usually get that later on in your life. And Mrs. Money can pay for a wonderful funeral for you. And Mrs. Money can do so much for you in this life, but can Mrs. Money go with you into death? No. After you die, Mrs. Money will go with your eldest son. Or at least with one of your children, maybe to the lawyer, I don't know. That's the inheritance. And the fourth wife, which you get last of all in life, is called Mrs. Fame. Your reputation, who makes many things possible for you, entry into the A-list of society maybe if you're very famous, and makes and will give you a good eulogy, a good word at your death, who you were, and what you did. But can your fame and reputation go with you? No, said the fourth wife, it can't be done. And that's the simile of the man with the four wives. It can be the woman with the four husbands. It's only a metaphor. Of all these things which we love and care for and think are ours, which we attach to, our fame, our fortune, our family, and this thing called karma. That's the only thing which you take with you. And if you think it all disappears when you die, I'm not going to go into all the evidence which is there for rebirth. What I am going to say is just how it must be, how it must work. Because as a monk, you spend, I don't know, I've been a monk for over 34 years, almost 35 years now, and I've been meditating a long time before then. As a monk, you understand just, you know, what is this thing inside of you we call a mind, what maybe Christians call a soul, the energy within you. And certainly through meditation, you isolate that energy, that mind force, and you can separate it from the body. And these deep meditations, and you don't have to go into very deep meditation. Many of you might have been meditating just beforehand and got into a peaceful state where you can't feel your body. And maybe you not even be able to hear sounds. We actually gone beyond the five senses of hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting and physical touch which define your body. Very, very often when you're a young monk, you almost had to do that. I remember this time as a young monk in first year in Thailand. This was again 34, 35 years ago. We started this new monastery in the jungle. And in the jungle there were these mosquitoes. Not one or two. Hundreds, thousands of them. And our teacher, Ajahn Chah, just gave no help to the Westerners. You just be like us. So he had no special privileges at all. And worst of all, in this monastery, when it first started, there was no hall, there were no toilets, there were no huts. We'd have a mosquito net where we'd sleep under. I remember many times putting a mosquito net in the jungle, laying down and seeing these deadly snakes slither by a few inches from your nose, just protected by this thin sheet of mosquito netting. Scary. Sometimes you're so tired you went to sleep anyway, who cares? And I always remember when we did have huts, even though there were huts, it still wouldn't keep the insects and the snakes out. I remember once during one of the ceremonies, we were doing some chanting and a snake crawled up this monk's back. And as a snake, I saw it because I was watching the monk and just behind his shoulder, a snake's head popped up. And this monk looked at the snake and the snake looked at the monk and they eyeballed each other. It was one of those amazing moments. That if you have we didn't have video cameras obviously in those days. We'd gone on the funniest home movie for sure. We'd have won a prize. The snake and the monk eyeballing each other because both were really surprised, wondering what to do next. And of course, what the snake did, the monk just very gently, because they're very kind, just gently pushed his robe off so the snake fell off without hurting it and just slithered away. And we had a very good relationship with snakes in those days, because this is one of the nice spiritual things about a monk. You can be kind, and that means they wouldn't worry you at all. I remember another snake story. I know it's nothing to do with reincarnation, but it almost killed me. So I suppose it's got something to do with rebirth. And at the time when we used to stay up all night once a week meditating, it was a very, very tough monastery, a very tough training we had. We'd go without sleep for about 36 hours once a week. So you can imagine, after staying up all night meditating, in the hot jungles, really sweating, mosquitoes around you and stuff, you got up early in the morning, you got up from your meditation, and of course, you just went outside to have a urinate. And it was, just at dawn. So there's two things to remember about this story. Number one, I hadn't slept all night, so I wasn't that mindful. And it was dawn, so the light wasn't very strong. And there were no toilets, so you just went into the forest, squatted down, and did your business. And I really did think that I was urinating on a stick. But when the stick started to move, I realized, oh my goodness, that was a snake. And if you think about it, especially you men here, that snake's mouth was only a couple of inches from the most sensitive part of a man's body. That was scary. But of course, the snake never bit me at all. It just slithered away and it looked actually quite happy. And I realise now why it was happy, because this was Thailand. These are Buddhist snakes. That snake probably thought it had just been blessed with holy water. Well, you can't get more holy than for the water direct from a monk's body. So that was the time I peed on a snake. There's many other stories like that. But actually, going back to the mosquitoes, so sometimes when you're meditating in that jungle, there's no mosquito nets. So we don't need to actually sleep under the mosquito net. The rest of the time we'll be outside. And we do these all group sittings, group meditation, usually in the evening. I don't know why our teacher had to sit about 6 p.m. It was just the time when the mosquitoes came out. And they came out for their dinner. And I was their dinner. And as I've mentioned here before, think about it again. Sort of as a monk, you've got more exposed skin. We have a bare shoulder. We have no hair. So literally, it's more seats at the dinner table for the mosquitoes. That's number one. More importantly, this, you know, we were some of the first Westerners in that area. I remember many villages where I went, people had never seen a white man before. I remember just going on alms round, and when people go, monks go on alms round, and people put food in a bowl, they're supposed to do it mindfully. But these people, they've never seen a white man before. So they're just looking at me, and all the food dropped outside the bowl. So I went hungry. It's very disappointing. Don't worry about what I look like, I'm hungry. But imagine the mosquitoes as well. That was the first time there was Western food in that forest. So you know what it's like when there's a new cuisine? You know, everybody wants to try it out. So all these mosquitoes were trying out the new Western cuisine, and they knew that it was safe, because we're not even allowed to swap them. It's really unfair. They take advantage of our compassion. So it was very, very tough to bear. And it was with another monk. We used to count the mosquitoes on our arm and head. And you get to somewhere like 60 or 70 at once. And you could not count, because they were too close together. You couldn't distinguish them. All you could do is hear this slurp, slurp, slurp as your blood was being drained from your body. That, of course, was my imagination. But the only way I could cope was actually by really meditating properly. In other words, I didn't have any opportunity to be dull or to lose my mindfulness and to be restless and think of all sorts of things. Because if my mind went away from my meditation object, which was the breath, straight away you'd feel your irritating, really itchy arm with so many mosquitoes on you. So you could, it really taught me how to meditate and go deep enough you could let go of your body. So you couldn't feel it anymore. You'd be deep inside, you know, with your mind, and you couldn't feel or hear or, you know, have any of the senses left. You were going deep in meditation. And as those meditations taught me about what this actual mind is and its energy and how it is really independent of your body, you can see that force and see that energy and see it, how it develops and how it moves, how it evolves. You can see what makes it go the way it does. We call it habit. And that habit is nothing more than what we call in Buddhism conditioning. It's actually all those influences which are on top of us that actually moves us in certain directions. That's that channels the energy of our mind, you know, into places which cause us a lot of suffering and a lot of distress. We can channel it into sort of some positive modes of thinking and being. And when we understand the power of that mind, it's so important to use this conditioning process, the influence, you know, of our environment, actually to channel it into good areas. Areas which can give you peace, satisfaction and happiness. When you actually can see it, when the body disappears, it's very easy to understand. It's very easy to sort of direct that mind. For example, you can see just how just complaining and negativity, once you get into it, you'll start to complain about more and more and more and more. We call that sort of in meditation the fault-finding mind. Once you get into it, it's just so easy to find another fault and another fault and another fault and another fault. And that is why relationships are just so hard, because once you start to see the first fault in your partner, then you can start to see all other faults as well. And it becomes just full of faults. And you why on earth did I ever marry such a person? I must have been blind. And the answer is yes, you were. That's what they say, isn't it? That love is blind. You've heard that saying before? So if love is blind, what's marriage? But an institution for the blind. I should have said that, should I? No, you can still have some fun time. But if you know how to channel your energy and don't be blind, it's amazing what you can do, even with a relationship. You know, you can actually channel the energy of the mind not to be so fault-finding, but to be more positive. As if the mind can look to the left or it can look to the right, but it can't look in both directions at the same time. If you get into that fault-finding, looking to the left, say, seeing the faults over there, the faults over there, the faults over there, you find you get more faults as you go along. Once you get into it, it's like a negative energy which infects the mind like a cancer, and the tumour grows and grows and grows and grows. You get more and more negative. And I see people like that. I see people, you know, they have a difficulty in their life, something goes wrong, and then they get into this feedback of negativity, and the negativity starts with a small little sound and ends up with a roar inside their mind. And it expresses themselves with the anger which they have towards other people, towards life. And they may not show the anger towards themselves. It's simple like negativity. Instead of that, you know, many of you have been coming here long enough, we actually train our minds into a more positive way. And it all needs is a bit more conditioning, a bit more sort of influence. Okay, let's be frank about it, more brainwashing. Every time you come here on a Friday night, you're being brainwashed. It's true, isn't it? You know this. But it's brainwashed in a nice way, and freeing you, giving you more energy, more positive ways of looking at life, which is why people come here. They want to be brainwashed, but brainwashed in a beautiful way. There's an old story from the Buddhist canon about this elephant. You know, in those days, people didn't have BMWs or Porsches. They had elephants. And this was a king, so this was, you know, really a high-class elephant. You know, the kings don't have any rubbish for their vehicles. And that's actually how you get places on elephants. So this king had a really nice elephant, you know, probably bought it from a very good dealer, you know, with all the extras. And so he bought a very expensive elephant. It was fine for a while, but after sort of a few years in the garage, it started to develop problems. And he tried to get it serviced, but, you know, even the elephant trainers, they couldn't fix up the problem. The elephant was just not behaving and not doing well, and was being very willful and negative and causing all sorts of problems. So the king wanted to get rid of that elephant. But there was a wise minister. There's always a wise minister in these Buddhist stories. It's a shame we don't have wise ministers in our state government, in our other governments. Maybe they have. But anyway, this was a very wise minister in our old king's government. And the wise minister said, just leave it with me for a while. This is really strange. How come this elephant changed character? So the wise minister, he just camped out next to the elephant stall overnight just to see what was going on. And he found out, when he was camping there, he heard a noise late at night. He investigated. That was a meeting place behind the elephant stall of a group of thieves who would meet there late at night and plan their robberies later on that evening. And because of the way they spoke, it was so negative, that was actually influencing the elephant. Even though the elephant couldn't understand human language, the elephant could still get what we call the vibes, the energy of these bad people. And obviously that had been going on so long after so many nights. So the minister understood what had changed the elephant's character. So the following day he told the king they had those thieves arrested, but that wasn't enough. They had to change the character in another way. So the king invited the monks every evening to go and meditate behind the elephant stall, do a bit of chanting and discuss, you know, some Dhamma. And the influence of those monks, you know, every evening for many weeks behind the elephant stall, and then the elephant became really peaceful and calm just like the monks. And that's how they fixed up the wanton elephant. So that's the old story. But as you can see how it works, how we do influence each other, how our minds are conditioned by the environment which we're in. So if on a Friday night you come here for week after week after week, I can guarantee that your character will become more peaceful, more kind, like the monks and nuns. But if you go and spend Friday evening down the pub or in the nightclub, then your mind will go in a different direction. I can guarantee that. And if you don't believe me, you can come here for many weeks, and if you don't change, you can get your money back. But of course you don't pay any money, so there's nothing to give you back. I don't say these things if I couldn't actually follow them through. But anyway, you can understand it how we do affect one another. And that the way our environment affects us, you can see just how that pushes the mind. It doesn't affect your body as much as this thing inside of you. And it's not just your environment, because you create that environment, the way you choose to think and to do things. And a common thing which I say here on a Friday night is when you get anger and want revenge against someone who hurt you, what does that do to your mind inside? People keep saying it eats me up inside. It is eating you. It's like an acid which is corroding, you know, your heart, making it smaller and more rusty. And it becomes a very difficult place to stay for you. And it's simply because the influence, you know, from outside and also from yourself is really negative. And what does it cost to let things go? To let that pain of the past go? What does it cost you? Nothing. What do you gain? You gain peace of mind. An ability to untie the shackles which link you to that painful experience of your past and set you free. And it's a wonderful thing to let that pain of the past go. It's wonderful for you. And when you learn how to do this, this is just the first part of the ability to let the mind be free and not be shackled to the negativity. There is a lot of pain in life. There is a lot of disappointments. There is a lot of frustration. And gee, I know about frustration, trying to get this damn retreat center finished in time for you. Well, it's really hard work. But you just give it your best. And if it doesn't work out, if the retreat center isn't finished, I've always got my air ticket to escape on Friday. But no, that won't happen. But what does happen is you have this positive attitude. No matter what happens, you don't need to bind yourself to the negativity and disappointments of the past. When you learn how to let go of those things, this is what we call really making good karma. What you're going to take with you. The ability to let go of things which you can't control, which are going to hurt you. And the ability to take a more positive attitude towards life, to enjoy life, and to see the beauty in things rather than the dullness in things. I remember an experience when I went to visit England for the very first time after I became a monk, about 7 or 8 years as a monk. And we had a monastery over there which was just building up. And so the abbot over there, Ajahn Sumedho, took me off with him to a tour of the north of England and Scotland. He was visiting some more remote Buddhist groups. And we went to this coal mining town of Darlington. We went there on a weekend for a retreat, and the first thing which the locals told us, it's very rare for someone to visit that run-down city on a weekend. Most people would get out on the weekend and go somewhere else. So we went to that town, and when we went for a walk in the morning after breakfast, we went to the gardens, and we found a beautiful little church to go and have a look inside. And when we went back, our host said, "Oh, where did you go for a walk? We told him, he said, "Oh, you went to the most beautiful parts of town. That's very indicative of your characters. Because there was a monk here a few months before. And when he went for a walk, he went down to the gasworks and the run-down old canal and the industrial area." And we laughed and said, "Yeah, that's his character. He's a very negative monk." You can just see just where you gravitate towards. Now, for those of you remember Ajahn Sumedho, a few of you, and myself, we're very positive beings. So, you know, given a chance to go to a walk, you know, you just go to the beautiful parts of town. Now you can understand the inclinations of where you go in your mind, in your life, with your body. Where do you incline towards? To the beauty of life or to the gasworks of life? And you can actually see that, because sometimes people get into sort of the bad memories of the path, they get into negativity, and if that's what you're doing, those inclinations, what would happen when you die? The same inclinations happen. You just get blown into that area. They often say that that moment of death is just a sum total of how you've lived. If you lived a very positive, peaceful, forgiving life, of course, it's easy to let go of the past. In this case, to let go of your life and go forward with a sense of freedom. You've always been so negative and so sort of upset and angry, you just can't let go. And be careful, because if you really can't let go of some of the unfinished business of life, you might come back as a ghost. Ghosts of people who just cannot let go some type of attachment they have, and they cannot let go of the past. I don't know how many of you have ever seen a ghost or heard a ghost or felt a ghost. I don't know if he's here this evening, but one of our members, he's got a great ghost story. One of his friends, let's go back for earlier. His friend, they moved to Australia, to Perth from England. Two young men, they were friends, so they shared a house together. As they shared a house, these two guys, you know, they weren't gay or anything, they were just save on rent, went out, had a great time. But one of them developed cancer. Very young, he died. But before he died, he always says, "I'm going to come back and haunt you." You know, like what some young people say, "I'm going to come back and haunt you." And apparently he did. And he was, you know, what you call those larrikins. Always like doing practical jokes. And so the other fellow who kept the house, you know, his girlfriend moved in after his mate died. And little things would happen, like being in the shower. And he would turn from the hot to cold. So he'd turn the hot on and it'd be boiling. Little silly things like that. But he said, and he's quite sure about this, one day he went out to work. When he came home, all the furniture from the lounge room was in the garden. And there's just silly little things, but sometimes, you know, if it's a friend, they do these little jokes on you. And his wife apparently could see him. His wife never knew him and could see this spectre in the house. And describe it, said, "Oh yeah, that's him." And so they just, after a while, just accommodate to these people. But this member of our Buddhist society, I better not say who it is, he went to visit his friend. He said, "I don't believe in ghosts, unless you're just making it up." And he was having coffee with his friend at the time. And his friend said, "Look, he's around, I'm sure he's around." And he asked his friend, "Come and prove to this visitor that you exist." There was a pot plant on the table. A leaf fell off that pot plant, floated horizontally, and then went down on the edge of the table, half on, half off. And the visitor said, "No, that's just a whim, just coincidence." And then another leaf fell off, horizontal, and then went vertically down, exactly on top of the second leaf. No, just chance. Third leaf, exactly the same, horizontal, straight down on the edge of that leaf. And our friend who comes here said, "I've got to go." And just jumped in his van and just put the foot on the accelerator, just went, didn't matter where. You have nothing to be afraid of. They're just ghosts playing around, but they're around because they're attached to things. So if you can't let go, that type of attachment, you have to understand how it works. You're attached to these things, you're attached to these places. Something happened and you will not leave it alone. If it becomes an obsession for you, then those obsessions, they will keep you attached to places and people for a long time after you're dead. Why? It's because the obsessive attachment to things, you just will not let them go. So those of you who come to places like this, you're taught how to let go of these things. You can let go of anything, and it's just so freeing to let go, so you can never have to be a ghost anymore. You know that, so mind can be free. And that's what we mean by like the karma which you take with you. Now you don't take things with you, it's these inclinations. And another good example, if you know how to be kind. That is something which you build up over many, many months, years of your life. A kind person is someone who practices and generates their compassion. And when you really get into it, it is a self-reinforcing spiritual practice. Because when you start to be compassionate and kind, other beings and people are kind to you. It's really fun to be compassionate and kind. Now people, if you're kind to other people, people show you their kind side as well. That's why that it's amazing just the life of a monk. You know, in all types of society, you know, you're with builders, you're with prisoners, you go overseas, and it's amazing how many people are kind to you and will help you out, even though you're just a monk and they may not even know you. So many people are kind and compassionate to you. Even just when I was going to Sydney last week, after giving a Friday night talk, the following morning, off to Sydney to give some talks, you get to the airport. And of course, the monks don't have any money. So how can a monk get himself a cup of tea? So you look around and kind to somebody. Say, "Oh, do you want a cup of tea?" "Oh, that'd be very nice, thank you." It's amazing, actually. Really, if you have a lot of compassion, you don't even need to have a credit card. It's amazing. One of our monks was trying this, because we always have these, sort of almost like competitions, to see whether these things actually work. And he decided, he came back from overseas to Perth International Airport, and he deliberately did not tell anyone of his flight details, when he was going to arrive. He just said, "I'll make my own way from the Perth airport to Bodhinyana Monastery of Serpentine." And he thought, you know, it's a long way, it's about 50 kilometres. And he didn't put his finger out to hitchhike, he just walked, just to see how powerful kindness was. He got about 100 metres from the airport when a car stopped, "Where are you going?" and gave him a lift all the way to Bodhinyana Monastery. And he was just so impressed, just how powerful kindness is. You see, so even if you're a monk, you don't need to have a car or a driver, you just go walking and people will stop and pick you up. It's an amazing life as a monk. And we try this out, it works. How does it work? Would you like to help out a monk or a nun? If so, why? There's something. Kindness and compassion and giving an example of something which is pure and lovely, which you like to support, which you like to hang out with. You can see just how that compassion and kindness sort of brings out kindness in others. Which is why when you start now a path of compassion and kindness, it's a reinforcing path. You meet other kind people. And it's fun to be kind. It's one of the nicest things you could do. Many people have done experiments. I think there was one done in, Yale University. And they gave all the students, it has to be done in the United States, you can never afford this in Australia these days, they gave every student $100. Half the students spend it on yourself, half the others you spend it on somebody else. And afterwards, to check who was happiest. If you had $100, spend it on somebody else or spend it on yourself. Which is the biggest bang for your bucks? It was so clear. When they did the test afterwards on the happiness levels, those who gave it away, spent it on charity to somebody else, were far more happy. And I mention that because at the building site today, I heard on their radio, I think that the government's $900 to every human being, to every taxpayer is coming through soon. So what are you going to do with your $900? Are you going to spend it on yourself? And waste the opportunity of becoming happy? Or are you going to make some good karma? You find actually, if you think about it, you actually get more happiness if you're generous and kind to others. So what you can do, go with a friend and say, I will spend it on you if you spend it on me. That we can both get our $900 and be compassionate at the same time. It doesn't work that way. So we can still be kind. And there we're developing an inclination. It's that kindness. That is, you know, what is almost inside the DNA which goes from life to life. That's the sweetness of the mango. If your first mango is sweet, you know your second mango, you know, its descendants are also going to be sweet. If your first mango is a sour mango, their descendants are going to be sour. That is actually what goes across. So when you're actually building things up in your life, you know, sometimes what actually goes across, you know, from life to life, it's those inclinations. This is actually the nature of the mind, how you're influencing it, conditioning and pushing it in a certain direction. There's ability to let go, to be kind, even to be gentle. Now, sometimes in life, you know, we're put in a difficult spot and sometimes we're too forceful. And that force which we sometimes have to generate, you know, in our work, it's this terrible thing we have to do this. But that forcefulness, that aggressiveness, if you have to do that in your workplace to get by, you take that aggression back with you, home, and you visit it on your partner. And unfortunately sometimes on your kids. It's a terrible, terrible thing that we live in such a world which is so aggressive and so competitive. Wouldn't it be lovely if our workplace could be reasonably peaceful and kind? And that's our attitude which we have during the day. So when we come home at night, that same attitude, that same conditioning can be with the people we love. And the love which we have with our family, we can take that into our workforce with us. Wouldn't it be a wonderful thing? It can be done. Whenever I've gone to human resources conferences, I talk at all sorts of weird events. This is with businessmen. I went to this big human resource conference in London a few years ago. They bought all the tickets for me. And biggest HR group in the whole of Europe invited me to give a masterclass. And I presented there this wonderful story of a British engineering company. I still remember their name, Farrelly and Sons. They got a prize, best business practice for that year. Because in 12 months, they had doubled their profits, trebled their turnover. So it's pretty good for a company to double your profits and treble your turnover. And they interviewed the MD. How did you do that? How can you increase your profits so much in 12 months? And he said, by a very, very simple strategy. Innovative, but unique. He said, we banned all overtime. No one in the company was allowed to work above their set hours, nor were they permitted to take any work home. And in 12 months, they trebled their turnover, doubled their profits. That's simple strategy. Radical. But think about it. Will it work? And how will it work? It's quite obvious when you think about it. If you get stressed out at work by doing too much work, when you come home, take it out on your wife, your husband, your family, have a terrible time at home, those problems, that stress, which gives a lot of negativity for most people, you visit that on your family, have family problems, so you don't sleep well at night, you go to work in the morning carrying all this unfinished business into the workplace, that stresses you out, your performance goes down. The negativity takes away your ability to work, to communicate with others, you just become a negative person. And all they needed to do was to ban overtime so people could spend time with their family without being so tired. So they went to work in the morning, refreshed, energized, so they could perform to a higher standard. Their output per hour increased. Not only that, they said the staff turnover fell to nil. No one wanted to leave such a company. The company were caring for them. So what do? If you're with a group of people or a company who actually care about you, you want to stay with them. You might not get as much money, but the quality of your workplace experience is so good you don't want to leave. That's why a simple act of compassion, of kindness, like banning overtime. You think, oh, you won't get as much work done, profits will go down. Opposite! You care for your workforce, look after them, increase their productivity, and then they'll stay. And also, when people leave a workforce, you know, you may have been in a company or an office and someone leaves, it's key people. It takes such a long time to hire another person and train them so they can perform. It takes a long time for you to know your job. That's why we try and retain people. And how do you retain people? Simple compassion and kindness, that's all. So it actually works. It actually works in the workplace, it works in the home. That's why it's such a positive thing. And if we can train ourselves like this, those are the inclinations which after a while become embedded in us and we become a kind person. Now, many of you may have had children. I often mention this, I never had children myself, obviously. At least none that I know about. I wasn't always a monk when I was young, but a long time ago now. But when you've witnessed your baby being born, or maybe even a grandchild, and you look at that being, It's not a clean slate, is it? They come into this life with a character, with a personality. And some of you may have seen these beings and realize these are old beings. There's a character inside of them. Inclinations. Those are the signs of where they've been before. And throughout their life, you have babies grow up into kids, adolescence, into adulthood. They are just generous, they are kind, or they may be mean, or they may be bullies. So where did that come from? It's obvious. These are the inclinations which they have built up in their previous lives. So those sorts of things, that type of karma, which you invest lots and lots of effort in, is never lost. Maybe your knowledge of how to fix cars or your knowledge how to kick a football, that might sort of disappear. But the qualities of kindness and knowledge and peace, that is something which is an investment which carries on from life to life to life. And personally, I was mentioning this in Sydney recently, it's a very radical and revolutionary idea. I mentioned this because I gave a talk and there was quite a few elderly people at the talk. And I said, if our governments would only realize that investing in you people who are 80, 90 years of age, is an investment for our future. You are tomorrow's youth. It's true, isn't it? Then we'd actually put more funds into old people's homes and looking after the elderly and thinking, instead of thinking, what a waste of a resource it is looking into after the elderly, just put them in a home, forget about them, because, you know, what does the country get out of you afterwards? Nothing. I often think that when people complain about the youth, and about, you know, juvenile delinquents or kids who don't respect their parents, where does that come from? Remember, all those children were elderly people who weren't respected. Now they're just getting their own back. From how they were treated as elderly people. Now they're young, you never respected them, now they're not respecting you. Makes a bit of sense to me. There's a generalization, but who knows. But you can see just how the whole idea of like rebirth and the karma, the conditioning, just the way that people are built, not physically but mentally, that becomes such an important thing, that this is actually how we can lead society, the long-term plan, not just this one lifetime, for goodness sake, but many lifetimes. As you solve the problems in this world, by developing kinder, more sort of peaceful, more wise, more sensitive human beings, and going for the long-term plan, maybe not this lifetime, but future lifetimes, for people who value peace more than aggression, people who are kind and value the sheer pleasure of kindness, and people who value peace above possessions, who realize that the whole purpose of working hard is find places of contentment where we can go home at night and really rest and be with the people we love. Not in separate rooms, but in a close, we used to have like the hearth side, people together. You don't need a big house to be together. You don't need much to actually have the beautiful and wonderful things of life. You don't need to be rich. All you need to do is to be wise. When we value wisdom above wealth, when we value kindness, you know, above aggression, then of course this world can be a wonderful place. So this is actually why we encourage these things, and why we invest, especially spiritually, in people of all ages. Doesn't matter how old you are, you'll be back here again later on. So, we look for the big picture, the long-term plan. So as you get people's inclinations moving in a more beautiful direction, other things you won't carry with you, you'll forget. But the inclinations, the kindness, the generosity, the peace, the ability to forgive, if you build that up in this life, may not be perfect, but it'll be there for you in your next one. And that's the most important. And that's actually classic Buddhism, and why the spiritual practice is a long-term proposition. But it does make you happier now, and happier later on, and creates a more peaceful world. So that's a little about the process of rebirth, the power of conditioning, and how it creates a more peaceful and happy world. So thank you for listening. So has anyone got any questions or comments on the talk this evening about how it all works? The big picture, yes. And back over there. Okay, you're asking about the ripening of karma. Some people think the karma ripens in this life. In other words, you do something bad and you get it back straight away, pretty quick. Or is it a ripening in past lifetimes? The first comment on the question, why do people always think that karma is bad things happen because you've done bad things? And even today, just talking to the builders at the retreat center, they told me they never heard of good karma. They'd only heard of bad karma. You know, you got cancer, you know, because you've done something really bad in the past. I like the other way of looking at karma. Now, are you happy? Are you healthy right now? You deserve that. Why? Because you've done some beautiful things in your past. Now, if you are, you know, reasonably well off, you deserve it. You've done something beautiful to deserve that happiness and well-being. And if you're fortunate enough to be in a beautiful relationship, a very sensitive and caring and very communicative relationship with another person, well done. You've made that happen. You've built it up. You've made good karma and now you're experiencing the results. So let's look at the good karma. So yes, if you do some good karma in this life, you know, you give a donation to some orphanage, or you just let somebody come in front of you in the traffic. Simple things. You're just kind. Someone at work is really in a bad space and you just spend time with them at the expense of your own work. How do you feel at the end of the day? Instant reward. Acts of good karma. Of course you get a reward from it. Many, many times. Every time I've gone out of my way to help someone. Someone told me in Sydney, I'd been in Sri Lanka, and they, you know, saw the video of my trip over there. And I gave many, many talks. But the thing which really impressed them was when a Sri Lankan old woman, Sri Lankan woman, wanted to come up and just bow to me. My minders said, oh, he's tired, and trying to push her away. And I told my minders, no, let her come. It doesn't matter if I'm tired, she may have come such a long way. Just that little act of kindness, he said, that was better than all your talks. That made such an impression on him. Little acts of kindness are huge. So a little act of kindness makes you very happy and many other people very happy. Instant karmic reward. Now that's the thing I encourage you to investigate. Not that I've got a hay fever, therefore I must have punched the holy person in the nose in my last lifetime. Because that's sort of negative, you know, karma, that's just, come on. How about the beautiful karma? Every time you're happy and enjoying life, remember you deserve that. Why? Find out why. Where your happiness comes from. And that's the beautiful part of karma. The forgotten side.